This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. These are pretty hard times right now for not only the world, but particularly for entertainers that are having some difficult time trying to get out there and make a living, and you can't, it seems like, and it's at least very difficult. People are trying to figure out how to kind of keep sane during this time, and we're sheltering in place, and who knows how long this is going to last. So, yeah, it's time that I think we need a little pick-me-up, a little joke, a little way to kind of smile at our situation. So please welcome my friend Norman Beck for just a few minutes, and sit back and be prepared to smile.
Joke hotline, how can we help?
You got something funny?
Well, I just came back from the liquor store. I got a 2-week supply of booze to kind of help me through this coronavirus stuff. It was my third trip this week. I said to myself that if we get through this, I was going to quit drinking. That's what the right side of my brain said.
Mm-hmm.
Left side of my brain said, don't take advice from a drunk. You know, I've been reminiscing a lot about this, my past, and one of my fondest memories as a child growing up was building sandcastles with my grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Till my mom caught me and made me put her back on the mantle in the urn. There was a couple, some friends of ours, that both came down with the coronavirus. And they went to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, there are two choices. You either need to be self-quarantined together, and the wife said, we'll take whatever choice B is. And I had another friend of mine that went, his wife went to get her tested, and they found out, doctors said, we're not sure, we got the test mixed up, and your wife either has the coronavirus or Alzheimer's. He said, oh, that's terrible. He said, what should I do? And he said, take her 5 miles out of town. If she finds her way home, don't let her in. You know, but I don't know if, Scott, if I told you or not, but I just came back from a trip up to Canada.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did. I went up there. I went on a little vacation. And when I was up there, I was parked at a place, and this Kenworth truck that was loaded with Worcestershire sauce that was driving down from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, with Worcestershire, whatever. So, yeah.
It was coming down towards me.
Yeah.
And I was in a Prius on the precipice of this ravine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Nissan Quasqua that had two urologists, an anesthesiologist, and a zoologist in it that ran a stop sign and hit the truck. Well, they careened off the road and went down in this ravine and came to a rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the phone. I called 911. And the dispatcher asked me, they said, what happened? I said, well, it's hard to say. And I was talking to some magician friends of mine about this coronavirus, and I said, when this is all over with, I want to go on a vacation. And my friend said, I got just the place. I got just the idea. I said, I'm not listening to you. I said, 2 years ago, you said, go on vacation. You said, go to Hawaii. Go to Hawaii. What happens? She gets pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I want to go on vacation. And you said, go to Hawaii, go to the Bahamas. And what do? We go to the Bahamas. What happens? She gets pregnant. this year I'm doing something after this coronavirus on the vacation with the wife. I'm going to do something different than I've done the last 2 years.
What's that?
This year I'm going to take her with me.
Okay,
she
then.
She told me the other day, she said, Norman, I think sex is much better on vacation than it is at home. You know, it was the worst postcard I ever got.
So have you been keeping socially distant during this time?
I was out at the cemetery the other day, walking around, and a policeman asked me what I was doing. I told him I was practicing that 6 feet of separation they've been talking about. Now, anyway, do you think that's enough? Will that be enough to cheer people up?
I think that kind of will put a smile or two on people's faces. I think those might be some things that could spread joy, and I think those jokes will be spread around then also.
Well, now I have one piece of wisdom for you.
All right,
now,
this is one piece of wisdom.
You know, with the coronavirus, there are really only two factors that contribute to the spread of the coronavirus.
Two factors.
Factor number one.
Yes, sir.
Is the density of the population.
All right.
Factor number two. Is the density of the population. Depends on how you look at it. It could be on how many people there are and how close they are together. It could be just how stupid somebody is.
Isn't that the truth?
You know, there was. I don't know if you saw this. This is not. There was an evangelical minister in West Virginia that said he was going to have services and he was going to preach and it was not going to infringe on his political or his religious belief. He was going to preach and he did.
Yeah.
And you know what? That sucker caught that coronavirus and died.
Oh, did he? Oh, mercy.
For real, yeah. And I told a friend of mine that, who's an atheist, and my friend said, well, maybe there is a God after all. So... anyway, I thought that was kind of tacky, but
kind of.
Anyway, well, listen. If these jokes were funny, they came from Norman Beck. If they were bad, my name's Jamie Ian Swiss.
Very good, Norm.
All right,
appreciate it.
Day.
Thanks a lot. You too, buddy. Bye now. Those are good ones, Norm. Thank you very much for putting a smile on my face. I hope the rest of you enjoyed that, too. For the last 2 weeks, we have had a contest going for two bundles of 5 ebooks that are available from Michael Breger, who is a friend of the Magic Word and also a columnist on the Linking Ring magazine or journal for the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And the winners' names will be announced at the end of this podcast. Also, towards the end of this podcast, please stick around because there's something in here for just about everybody. There is a new project that we're starting called the Magician's Relief Project. And this is something that's going to be able to help people in a financial way who are in need right now during this difficult time. So stick around till the end of the podcast and see how that you can perhaps be a recipient of some of these funds. Well, all right, now it's time to get into the main event. This week's episode is brought to you by our friends over at themagicbookshop.com. Please take a look over at themagicbookshop.com if you're looking for anything to read. They've got just all of the great books, new, used, old, and rare books. They've got it. If you're looking to buy something or if you have a collection you want to sell or if you have just a book that you're thinking about selling and you're wondering how much that it might be worth to a reseller, you might want to give Eric Citron a call or just drop him a line. If you just go over to themagicbookshop.com, there you'll find everything that you really need to know. They've got a lot of really great books. I say all of them. There's some that are, I can't find The Discovery of Witchcraft, the original one. I don't think they've got that. But they do have a lot of other reasonable books that you can certainly find. And if you use the promo code MAGICWORD, all one word, no hyphens or spaces, you'll get a 15% discount off of any and all purchases over there. So thank you, Eric, very much for again sponsoring the podcast over here. Well, this week, I know that we've got just a lot of conventions that have been canceled or postponed over the ensuing months, and it's unclear as to how many more will be affected by this as we continue on with this. But we're going to speak this week with a gentleman, Mr. Joe M. Turner, who is from Atlanta, Georgia, who has attended several of these conventions, not as many as me. I believe I've been to about 35 of them, and I believe he has been to maybe about half that many or so. But we have a lively conversation talking about the convention that will not be this year. That is, typically I would be attending the Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic, which is now known as Obie's 4F. And by attending that, I usually would give you my daily updates, and you get to hear from the convention attendees, the talent, the dealers, the organizers, etc., and kind of get a good feel that if you don't attend the convention, that you feel as if that you are there. Well, in this week's episode, we get to talk about some of the past conventions, so this way that you get a flavor of that. For those of you who have never attended or haven't had the opportunity to attend, that we go into a little bit of detail as to what the convention is like, so you kind of get to the feel of that, certainly. That's because it's a different kind of a convention. I know that if you ever have an opportunity to attend, that you should. And then towards the end of the conversation, we do talk about just what's happening with conventions in general, and perhaps what's going to be happening with the future of magic conventions. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Joe M. Turner, here on The Magic Word. Well, this week we're going to go back and visit with someone that I've been wanting to revisit with for quite some time, a good friend of mine and of yours and of magicians in general around the world, because he's a past international president of the Magicians, International Brotherhood of Magicians, the IBM, and also he has been a corporate performer, a speaker, and I say has been, still is as well, and performing nationwide, and has performed on television, then on CNN, as well as other places then as well, plus comes out of Atlanta, Georgia, where he has been the Magician of the Year in the past. And so please welcome my friend again, Mr. Joe M. Turner. Hey there, Joe.
Hi, Scott. Good to see you.
Hey, and good hearing you then, too. And I say see you, yeah, because we're actually talking via Skype then right now. So it's good to see you then as well. Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk about here today, you know, has to do with Obie's 4F convention. And you have been intimately involved with that for a long time because you have been one of the presenters, I should say, a master of ceremonies. And we're not attending the 4F convention this year because of the the sheltering in place that we've had right now. So a lot of conventions have been canceled. So since we can't give like daily updates or anything as to what's going on, can you give them a little bit of a sense about what the 4F convention means to you and what it's like?
Sure. I started attending the 4F convention in 2004 after having heard about this legendary invitation-only close-up convention for many years, and was trying to figure out, well, how does one get an invitation to this thing? And I finally got to go, and it really is – it was small and interactive and engaging, and I mean, of course you saw things performed that weren't even being released to the magic community at large for another year or two or more. You were seeing some really groundbreaking things, but you got to eat and drink and hang out with everybody. Some of the best magic that you would see wouldn't even be in the performances. It would be at those tables in the backside, sort of the backstage area, where people would just hang out and jam until all hours of the morning. People were friendly, and it was just – I think now there's a lot of smaller conventions that have really focused on the relationship side of things, but I think the 4F probably was early in recognizing how valuable the personal relationship piece of a magic convention could be.
Yeah, you're talking about where that they're trying to – you're not talking about familial relationships. I mean, where it's more of a family convention. You're talking about where it's really more one-on-one kind of a thing?
Well, I think there's elements of both in it. I think – as large conventions have generally struggled in general, the big large conventions of the IBM SAM, Magi Fest, and some other, and Magic Live have held sway. They have very creative leadership and organization and different way of managing things.
Right.
But as some of the other large organizations have struggled with large conventions, the smaller conventions have become very popular. And I think they have learned to market themselves calling that out as one of their features, as to how a small convention can allow people to develop relationships more easily. You interact with not just each other and attendees, but also usually the performers. And so many of the traditional regional and city type conventions, I think, have learned to shine a spotlight on that. But I will say that the 4F, even though it's an international convention, has always been on the small side, being an invitation only event. And as a result of that size, I think it focused on that relationship building as a feature sooner than many others did.
You know, that's an interesting point. I really hadn't thought so much about that, Joe, but that's a brilliant observation, and thinking about how that it started small but stayed small with the intention of being small, whereas most conventions, as businesses, start out small hoping to be big, you know, and want to get more and more.
And certainly even 4F has grown, as we all know, but it still targets itself to be a pretty small convention. And that invitation only aspect, they're trying to preserve that. There are other small conventions that are even smaller than that that are open.
Yeah, that's true. And there are some that are invitation only, kind of a thing, like a Pebble Palooza. You know, there's really an underground kind of a thing that is almost starting to take the place of the 4S convention. But because of just like the reason that they were small in the beginning at the 4F convention, because they were limited by the size of the Forks Hotel, how many people could fit upstairs there. Likewise, like with the Pebble, that it is something that is limited by the size of the small banquet room that they have, you know, kind of there too. But there are still that many people and more who are just hanging out in the lobby who are not registered just to come out for the hang, you know.
Well, and what I would say, just to go along with that, is there's absolutely nothing wrong with a big convention. I love it when I get to go to big conventions and small conventions, and trying to judge them against each other is like trying to judge
favorite child.
Well, no, I kind of think of it more, if you've been to the Louvre or to art museums in general, you know, one of my favorite paintings is the Coronation of Napoleon. It's this giant, massive, epic painting. You know, it takes up a whole wall.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, you've got the Mona Lisa, which is a much smaller painting than you would expect. Mm-hmm. And to ask yourself which of those two is better – or more me. I mean, it's trying to judge a large scale painting as better or worse than a small scale painting as better or worse based on the size is not a profitable comparison. In my view, they have value beyond the size, and the size of the canvas is just a constraint that inspires creativity in the producers, and they have to produce things differently based on, you know, the kind of canvas that they're painting on. And the same goes with convention producers.
That's true. It is subjective as to what that you like. I remember when I saw the Dutch Masters, I always remembered just the picture like on the cigar box or something, but then when I actually saw it, it just, as you said, the Coronation of Napoleon, it took up a whole wall. It's like, I did not expect to see that huge of a thing, bigger than a garage door kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But it kind of reminds me of perhaps a line from, was it Dr. No or from Rush with Love, you know, and James Bond. No, it was from You Only Live Twice, which that he had said, well, just as beluga caviar is different from Dom Perignon, you know, that they're both are different, but I love them both, you know.
Sure. Well, so all that to say, I love the 4F, and
yeah,
I love it for what it is, and it's one of the first conventions that I got to go to regularly where that small relationship.
When did you first start attending? When did you get your invitation first?
I first went to 4F in 2004. Pat Page was the guest of honor. Never forget it. He's one of my favorite personalities in magic, certainly at the 4F, but in general, I just admired him so much. And that was just one of the great experiences of my life to get to meet him and hang out with him and have him show me some things. And we got to be friendly. I would never call us personal friends. I didn't reach that stratosphere, but we were friendly on many occasions, recognizable personalities, acquaintances at different conventions and events. But to see him there was such a great treat. So he's just one of many such personalities at 4F.
I think you put your finger on an interesting point, not just the 4F convention, but I believe in conventions in general. And that has to do with the friendships that you make after you go year after year and you meet somebody. And the next time it's like, oh, you kind of recognize them. And the more frequently that you attend this convention, then the better and deeper that your friendship becomes, certainly. And particularly, let's say like the 4F convention, whenever that I would see some of my fellow 4Fers, I guess, at another convention, it's kind of like, you know, hey, Gary, hey, Steve, Bob, you know, different people that you recognize. And also that the people who are lecturing and performing at the 4F convention are often the featured performers and lecturers at other conventions will attend. So it's, in other words,
correct,
I've already seen you before, you know, but I'd like to see it again and support what you're doing. But it's interesting when people will be going to the to factors that they will get a little bit nervous. I remember Roger Klaus muffing his $100 bill switch, you know.
Of all
people, exactly, because he was nervous. I remember Bud Dietrich also was nervous watching him perform there one time at the Forks Hotel.
I remember one time I blew a trick. I forget if it was my second or third time there, and it just wasn't going well, and I had to sort of reset some things and finally got through the set. And I was just angry at myself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple of spots later, J.C. Wagner came out and it was a disaster. It just, everything fell apart. Nothing went right. Balls are falling off the table, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's real life. And all of the people that you admire and all of the people that you think are these magical demigods, which they are, I give them, but human beings encounter difficulties. And so it happens, but if it's going to happen, that's the place for it.
Yeah. That did happen with me also. And I remember something that I had done just as you were talking about on a regular basis, never had a problem with. And I miscounted something. It's like, oh, and I looked up and there's Paul Daniels, who was a guest of honor, I think, that year. And he was sitting in the front row and he just kind of smiled. And I started and just redid it again, you know, and went through and it finished then fine. And I remember when he lectured, he was talking about sometimes that things go wrong and you just need to do it again. And he just kind of stared at me like, don't you? You know, kind of a thing. So they definitely happen.
I was doing Trevor Lewis's homing card routine that I had learned from Bob Sheets, and something stuck together and I pulled off two instead of one, but you get the cards out of order and it just isn't going to go. And Bob Sheets was there and he came up to me afterwards and he's like, oh yeah, man. Once that happens, you're out of luck. You know, he totally,
it's like the thread breaks. There's nothing you could do.
We've all been there. If you perform on a regular basis, then things happen.
But the nerves are a little bit higher too because of what you just said. I'll never forget. I wish I remember who it was, but a fella had sat there and he just stared at the audience and kind of, you know, his head was going back and forth. And then finally said, you know, I've got your books. I've seen your DVDs. I've attended your lectures. I've watched you perform. I've seen you. And he's pointing at each of these people. And it's like, what am I doing here?
That front row in 2004, I walked out and, you know, it's Pat Page and Ali Bongo and Herb Zero and, you know, it's
Roger Klaus and Howie Schwartzman.
Roger Klaus. And you just sit there like, okay, everything I'm about to do, you all have published versions of.
Simon Aronson and everybody.
Either invented it or varied it or improved it or, you know, so, but they just want to see you do it well. It really, over the years, I've learned that it's another audience and they're in on everything, of course, but they want it to be good. They want you to succeed. They want to be happy. They're very generous with their applause and standing ovations. And
yeah, and oh, sure. Sure.
So it's I don't want to give the idea that it's this cabal of, you know, judgy experts. It's really not that at all. They're just
friends.
Very friendly and mm-hmm. supportive, and I sure miss them. I sure miss not being there this time. But
yeah, I do too. You know,
Good call. The board made the right decision. I miss seeing everybody.
I got to tell you a story along that line before I forget it, and I think it's important to kind of mention this. And back when we were at the Forks Hotel, and it was after one of the sessions, and we were around the bar down the stairs, and I have a deck of cards, and there's a guy sitting next to me who I hadn't met, but I had seen him. He was an older gentleman than me and probably about, I don't know, 30 years my senior. And I was probably in my 40s at the time, I guess. And so anyhow, so I started doing this trick and going through with my pattern and what I was doing. And he was saying, yeah, and he said, that's good. He said, I like that. And he said, but let me show you the way that I invented it. And so then he started showing it to me, and as he was doing it, then I was remembering the name of the trick was called Dave's Delight, and I was thinking Dave's Delight was invented by a guy named Dave, and I looked at his name tag, and he was Dave Letterman, that's with a D, Letterman.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're the guy. It's like, here's where you go, not only to see your heroes, but also to learn from the people who create this stuff, you know.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Well, anyway, I was honored. Steve, I would never have made it without encouragement from Steve Bargatze,
mm-hmm.
Who has since been a guest of honor, and of course Dan Garrett and John Miller here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And Rachel Wild.
Mm-hmm. Boy, bless her. What a wonderful lady.
And later Rachel Colombini. But the time was going by Rachel Wild
with Tom Jones
and with Tom,
yep.
Another great forever.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get up the nerve to, and Steve Bargatze was like, go do something for Obi. We were at an IBM convention or some other convention. He's like, Joe, you got to go do something for Obi. And I'm like, I'm not grasping onto the ring there as I should have. And he said, well, come do it for Rachel. And so I went over there, and Rachel was like, yeah, you should go do it for, you know, do that.
Yeah.
And so they were just really encouraging me to go perform for Obi so I could get a, you know, be on his radar. And
so did you?
I did. I finally did some magic for Obi, and Obi, I have some pictures of me doing some work for him later on, and he really likes my memorized deck work. He thinks I'm good at that.
Well,
I know
are.
That. Well, I'm okay at it, but I know the people who are better. But he always asks me to do something with that when he sees me. So,
mm-hmm.
Anyway,
does he ask you to show it to him, or does he normally say, "Hey, show so and so"?
Show someone else.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he'll say, "Hey, do something for
Exactly. You know, that's the way it is. You know, whenever that you have been in a cocktail setting and you're walking around, you know, and you fool somebody badly, you know, and you know that you have, because that's whenever they say, "Hey, come over here and show Bob this. Show Susan this that trick you just showed me." But I hate it whenever it's going to be show them the thing with all the bunnies come out of your
hand.
Oh,
yeah. At least
or
Obi
cigarette
knows
goes to the quarter.
To, so. Obi knows because he knows not to say the climax when he tells you what to do. But it's good times. I'm so fortunate that I've gotten to know him and Joan and Mare. And I mean, I've known Dan, but, you know, just to hang out with everybody there and to be an MC there over the last, I've lost track of the years that I've been an MC at 4F. After having done my bachelor's and master's and doctorate, some time went by, a few years, where I would pitch in other ways. And then one year he emails me and it's like, I need you to be an MC for this show. And for a while I was the MC of Wednesday night.
Right.
And then
it's kind of the opening night.
Mm-hmm. It's the opening night. I did that for a few years, and then I think they were having a different show on opening night. Maybe it was the Canadian show, or I forget, but they switched to having like an MC from the lineup when they started doing country-based shows on Wednesday night.
Like Italy,
and I moved to Thursday or Friday afternoon. But that's great. I just, it's great fun.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you about then also, for you to elaborate a little bit more for those people who, again, who haven't attended the convention, and for others who are not there to kind of feel like they're there, is to talk about kind of what the format is of the shows and the people who MC the shows each day.
Okay. Well, interesting thing about 4F, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I've been going for 15 or 16 years now, but I don't know all the details. Everyone attends, and all of the performers are essentially attendees, and you're sorted into a performance session, and there's different shows that happen each day that will have anywhere from 8 to maybe 12, hopefully no more, but performers.
Yeah. And they're limited on time, too.
Yeah, you're limited on time. You're supposed to do, 8 minutes or less, depending. Less. They'll be giving you. I mean, some of the headline type acts, they'll give them time to do their whole FISM act or something. Mm-hmm. But someone who's going for the first time they perform, every first timer is supposed to perform their first time at 4F, and they'll be put on one of the shows to come out and do 3 or 4 minutes and just do something. And once you perform the first time, you get your bachelor's degree in magic from Obie's 4F. And then, either the next year or some years later or many years later, depending on, multiple factors, you'll be asked to perform again. And the second time you perform, you get your master's. And the third time you perform, you get your PhD. And it's sort of a rite of passage that over the years you try to get all of your degrees.
But not everybody has those.
Not everybody has those. I think
just because you come every year. I mean, I know some guys who have been coming for 30 years who may only just have their master's and never got their doctorate.
Well, I don't know all of the ins and outs of how those decisions get made. As an MC, I get handed a list of people that I'm told these are the people that'll be on your show.
So you don't select them at all?
I have zero selectivity in that. In fact, even after I get to the convention, people will be coming on and off my list even during the week that we're there sometimes. They'll be making changes to lineups. My understanding is that in the old days, everybody would perform and you were supposed to be ready to go. And you didn't know if you were going to be asked to perform or not. And so you would be there and then they would call you up. And if you didn't perform, you wouldn't get invited back. I don't know if that's.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. It used to be
the way it was, is you're expected to contribute. And so now you're assigned a performance spot. And so, before you get there that you're going to be on the show. So that's a little bit different. What the decisions are that who gets on when, I'm sure that if you do a good job, you're more likely to be asked back sooner than if something goes wrong.
Right.
So I was lucky, I guess, that some of my difficulties happened later in my career. I remember the first one I did, everything went just right, but I chose material that was bulletproof for the first one. So.
Yeah, I think that it's true that it used to be that in the earlier days when it was back at the Forks that they had invited people but not certain who all was going to be showing up. And once they got there, then, you would have something that would be in your registration packet saying you're on the 2 o'clock show, or whatever. And so then you knew. And so everybody brought stuff with them not knowing if you were going to perform or not. And then as we started having more and more international talent, then I think that there got to be a little bit more handpicked and more selections as to, well, we've not heard nor seen this guy, so let's do that, which is another thing that Obie has done over the years is that, again, they used to be that we've always had great lectures, but he has stopped, for the most part, of having American lectures in lieu of having those who are coming from overseas to lecture, because we don't get an opportunity to see those guys anyhow. Mm-hmm. So I might as well hear what they have to say, because we can hear Americans anytime, kind of a thing. I mean, they can tour around here easier
other
than they could.
Other conventions and lecture tours.
Correct. But if somebody's coming over for a one-time thing from Italy or Spain or Greece or Germany or wherever, that he also wants to give them the opportunity to make some money to help help offset their transportation expenses. Costs and everything, yeah, all their expenses. So there is a concerted effort, I think, to try to have people, our overseas guests, actually lecture. So, yeah, that's one thing that's kind of changed over the years and has continued to be an international thing. Going back to the original thing when it was formulated by Eddie Fechter, that it was at the Forks Hotel. And as I recall, that they just had like a little one-inch ad that was in, I think, Genie Magazine, basically saying that we're going to be having a convention in Buffalo, New York at the Forks Hotel. If you're, you know, there was just a convention ad, but little kind of a short thing. It wasn't a big banner or anything. And a few people showed up, and basically that as it got started, they were kind of around the table, you know, with Tom Craven, Eddie Fechter, and Carl Norman, and all these guys, you know, kind of sitting around the table and kind of passing the deck of cards. Okay, you go next, and you go next. And yep. Then because it was at the Forks and they had food and drink, then they would perform for the patrons. And then on Friday night, they had a fish fry. Then they go back, you know, in the kitchen and pick up the fish, and that's kind of like, you know, that's included in your registration thing. And then it started to get a little bit larger, and then again, it got so that they were capped out because of the size of the, they call it the Forks Hotel, but really, I guess at one point it was a roadhouse where they had one or two rooms they rented out upstairs. And they stopped doing that, I don't know how long ago. Of course, the place has since burned down and they moved, but I remember that they would use those rooms at one point for dealers. I remember Howie Schwartzman, you know, having a little dealer booth set up in one of these little rooms. It looked like a closet, I mean, but apparently
Howie.
That was that was just a little room.
I'll say that a lot of this I learned from Dick Cook's DVD that he gave the attendees back maybe 10 years ago. I don't know. He made a history of the 4F 2008 or 9 or 10 or somewhere in there. Hmm. He came to the convention and he had made a video that was sort of the history of the Forks and of Fechter's and the, you know, over the years. But so a lot of this I have only seen. I only saw pictures of the Forks Hotel. I only saw pictures of and video of Eddie Fechter. I never got to see the 4F in full, you know, all its old style glory. But there are some video clips that have survived and that have been shared with attendees. So that's really the only touch into the history that I've ever been able to see.
One of the things, of course, they used to do, which was the roast, and they still kind of do that, I guess, on the final night, whoever the guest of honor is. And each year that they do have a different guest of honor. This year was supposed to have been
Mark Mason,
that's right. And it's one of those things in which they, I think it used to be, try to embarrass them as much as possible. I mean, it's truly an old type of roast. You know, back in the days with Jay Marshall and Tom Mullica, I mean, they were some hilarious, very rude kinds of things. And back then, it was a male-only kind of a thing. And then a little at a time, we had more and more women who were starting to come. As I recall, one of the first people to attend was at Bunny Robbins or somebody named Spina. It wasn't Joni Spina, but anyhow. But we had very few women, so it was just kind of a male-oriented kind of thing back in the early days, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, kind of
right.
A thing. But, you know, whenever Gary Ouellette was the guest of honor, that being the, was he like a head counsel in Canada? I mean, he had a very high title as well in the government there in Canada and highly respected, and as a result that Obie said this year we're going to be having really an honorarium and give, I mean, we're going to honor the person
right.
Rather than roast the person. And it was just the most lukewarm, you know, milquetoast thing. It's kind of like, well, this guy has done this, so congratulations for, you know, here's another thing for you. And it was not fun or funny. And this kind of, that was the beginning of the end of the raunchy ones.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's acceptable in society has changed. I mean, I can remember as a kid turning on the Dean Martin roasts even.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
you could make primetime television out of roasting people. And
yeah.
You don't really see that. You know, that had its day.
Yeah.
And appropriate or inappropriate, but certainly acceptable in the time. But it's not the same anymore. And I know that to the degree that certain roasts in recent years have gone you know, cross some lines maybe. I think it's probably for the best that they've toned it down.
Well, until it came
that's to- just my opinion as a guy who's come into this, you know, in more recent times, I guess.
And I understand that. But whenever I had attended the IBM SAM joint convention earlier this year in Las Vegas that was hosted by Mike Hammer, it was for the Matt King thing, there was nothing that was held back.
Point made. That's a fair point. It may also just maybe it's a function of the personalities involved and the expectations that people have when they go into that. So I was telling someone earlier, context is everything in humor,
right.
Certainly. And if you go into a room expecting things to be of a certain nature, then I guess if it turns out to be that way, it's fine.
Right. Is there somebody
I'm a prude about it. I think that it's a more complex situation at 4F, the more international it has become.
Yeah.
To try to roast people and communicate to a really extensively diverse type of an audience compared to your standard, you know, group of Vegas folks or something. You know, I don't mean that in an ugly way, but I just think the type of humor that translates is it's difficult to predict. And I'm not sure that a roast in a fully international audience would always be perceived as within expectation.
You know, that's a good point because of different cultures, how that they may perceive something as being not only less funny, but not appropriate, you know, in from their country, whereas here in the U.S. or, like you said, with in Las Vegas or wherever, that it might be more acceptable, you know, where you're not putting somebody down.
I mean, expectations and context.
Yeah, there
and
you go. Yeah.
Those are the two factors.
So in the 4F over the years, who have been some of your favorite people that you remember seeing their lecture or watching them perform, or whether they were a guest of honor or just an attendee?
Well, I've already talked about Pat Page and how much I admired him. Hanging out with Gene Anderson.
Going and having breakfast with him. And I always like the fact that he wants everybody to catch up. What have you done this year? You know,
that was always fun. Let's see. I've already Steve Bargatze. I wouldn't even have been able to go without his sort of.
And he and Rick Merrill close usually on Saturday nights with their very original one-time only kind of performances.
And with little digs and the occasional more direct punch at someone in a roasty way, but it's all very funny, and I've only rarely felt like it was, you know, most people take it in the spirit in which it's intended.
Sure, sure.
I think that's great. Rocco Solano. Rocco is the big end of act one on the closing night show. And so
because you got to clean up after him. Yeah.
Yeah. You do have to lay down tarps for Rocco. But the point I was to your point of, you know, who do you remember? I mean, just when unbelievable, unexpected things start appearing in his hands. Mm-hmm. It just cracks me up, you know, and he's so funny and clever when, you know, a fudgesicle or a popsicle or something, ice cream cone suddenly appears in his hand. It's just, it's pure magic. I'll tell you something that comes to mind that it's people that don't often get talked about, I guess, but when Bruce Calver and Joan Caesar lectured on the two-person code, Bruce Calver's two-person code quickly learned.
Right.
That sticks out in my mind. Remember Peter Tappan?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
gone now. One of the greats. And I can remember hanging out with Peter, and we would go to dinner and sort of brainstorm our way through something we had seen and try to say, well, you know, what is a possible method? We couldn't necessarily identify exactly what was happening, but just to puzzle over things that we had seen. And I have in my notes solutions to things that we saw that Peter and I just threw back and forth and tried to figure out. And he was never a guest of honor, but he's certainly someone who had a great influence on the way I enjoyed Fechter's over the years. Roger Clouse, the great gentleman in magic, respectful and polite and always sharply dressed and ready to go. And he's inspirational. As a personality, and besides the magic, just what a great gentleman he was. Hanging out with Sean and David Stone and Oscar and some of those guys is always fun. And they've all been guests of honor, so people know those names, but I think about some of the folks from the older days that I don't get to hang out with anymore. They've gone. They can't come. You know, Howie, is no longer able to come. Howie Schwartzman, filthy.
Always had a joke. I always had a joke. Whenever there was a lag of time, it's okay. Howie, tell us a joke, and he would stand up.
He would stand up with something, and he told a few that I couldn't tell in polite company, but I keep him in the back pocket for the right situation that I learned from Howie. So God bless him.
I'm glad you mentioned Peter Tappan. That is a name from the past, certainly, who was a great guy and one. He had written, I think, with Phil Wilmorth some books, or I think on the. The Prince's Card Trick. I think that he wrote that book.
The Imposterous Princess.
That was it. Yeah, that's it. But I remember going to his room after that. We were at the old place when we go to the Forks, and we were staying at this little motel, the Thrifty Nickel or the Nick, whatever it was. And he would always have these little bottles of alcohol that he had taped shut, that he, back when we could fly with, alcohol and liquid, and he would just bring all these out, and we would just, he and I and a couple people would sit there and have a drink, beforehand. So it was just before the convention kind of began, he'd pour out of these different little bottles. Another one's Dan Garrett and Gene Anderson. You mentioned Gene whenever that they used to do the Garnack.
Yes.
It was hilarious.
It was funny. I think they had started to wrap that up by the time I attended, but they did bring it back the year that they were guests of honor. Mm-hmm. And I think Garnack may have shown up a couple of times since I've been there, but it's hilarious, classic things sometimes that you only see at 4F.
Well, another thing, too, that makes 4F unique are the different parties that we had throughout the convention in the evenings, in which that, late at night, of course, then they would have the hospitality room open, and they would, I always tell people that we learn magic all day long, and then they bring out donuts and coffee at about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and then we keep on going for the rest of the night, And not only just the hospitality room, but then, because Obi says, don't take any donuts back to your room. This is not to, this is a place where you're supposed to just have hospitality. Don't come and, grab some food and go back to your room and to your hole. Basically, stay here, while you're eating then too. But there were other rooms that, like the precursor suite for the precursor magazine. That
a little smaller, a little more, I don't want to use the word underground because, you can go. It's not.
It was open. Yeah.
It's open, but it's just lesser attended, I guess, less crowded. And then, of course, there's lots of people just have their own parties.
The Italians have great
Italian party is exactly what I was thinking of. God bless them with the limoncello and the hanging out in there.
And the
that
cheese
place
they bring.
Crowded.
Mm-hmm.
The cheese and the special other things that they bring is really delicious and fun and such great guys. And I know people, these relationships that you build last all year long, and you go visit people from 4F in other parts of the world, and they will help you out in different ways. I know Will Fern relied on 4F relationships, when he was in Rome proposing to his wife, 4F buddy helped him put that together. And when I had the opportunity to travel with my daughter last year, we stopped in Mauritius on a cruise, and able to connect with William there. Yeah. So, the connections that you make are they're more than your usual magic convention connections. There is a family element to it that lasts from April to April, and in this case to yet another April.
That's right, because they're not going to be holding the 4F convention. This was to have been our 50th anniversary of this, so it was pretty monumental, and I know a lot of people were planning on coming, and there were a lot of big activities and things planned, so they're just kind of putting us off then for another year, and so next April that we'll pick it up again.
Yep. Can't wait.
Nor can I. Now, one of the things we kind of touched on also earlier on was just about conventions kind of in general. Now, you have been past international president. Well, you are past international president of the IBM, and have also hosted conventions like the Society or the Southeast Association of Magicians, the SEAM. Is that right?
SEAM. Yeah. It's kind of a defunct convention at this point.
The conventions have come and gone. I guess that's kind of where I'm going, you know, with that.
Yeah. I would love to see the SEAM come back, but I think that there for a while it would bounce around from location, from city to city, and different cities in the Southeast would take on the task of doing it, and it just became to where nobody would be willing to do it. And Atlanta ended up doing it a few times, and Nashville, but you know, after Raleigh, North Carolina did it a couple times, and then Atlanta a couple times, and Nashville a couple times. It just kind of petered out. The last time it happened in Atlanta, Ken Scott was the convention chair for it, and I really think that it has sort of largely morphed into he took over the Atlanta Harvest of Magic, and I would say that, you know, a lot of the lessons learned in his production of that last SEAM in Atlanta have fed into the way that he manages the Atlanta Harvest now. And so he just, that's his thing. And I think that's largely taken the place of an SEAM.
What was the couple's name who used to run the Atlanta Harvest?
Jim and Diane Maney.
Maney. That's him. Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the earlier conventions I had attended because I didn't know some of the people who were on the bill that year, and I'm so glad that I went because I was wanting to see and meet these people, which included Terry Seabrook, who got to be a lifelong friend, and then also watching Slidini. I think it was one of his last performances there, and doing his Linking Rings in a little Matador outfit, you know, and that was one of the last times I had seen him. I had seen him perform and been around him for different times at different conventions, but Joe DeLion was another one who was performing that particular year, and I'd forgotten a couple of other people, but that was memorable. And we also went to the – we all packed in this little Volkswagen or something where we all went to the Viceroy. Or where is that where they make the onions?
Onion the Varsity? Rings?
Varsity, that's it.
The Varsity. What do you have? What do you have? The Harvest was the first magic convention I ever attended. It was still being done by Jim and Diane in the late 90s. And I remember Tom Craven and Jerry Mincer and Jeff McBride were on the bill. And so I couldn't believe that there was such a thing as a whole weekend of people doing magic. I had never, you know, thought that such a thing was even existed. I'd seen the magazines when I was a kid, and I thought about big conventions and how, you know, you would go to Tannen's Jubilee or IBM or SAM, these giant things that were just so far away for a kid from Mississippi. That's just not something we were going to be able to do. But after I was an adult and living in Atlanta and found out the Atlanta Harvest, really? What's that? Oh, we just hang out all weekend and there's magic and performers come in. And so I'm in. And so that and the Winter Carnival were the conventions that sort of got this started. And then my first national convention was IBM Orlando 2001, I guess. And Amos McCormick from Mississippi said, come on, you're going to the convention. And made me go, got me a registration, just handed it to me and said, you're going, come on. And I was like, really? And that was my first national convention.
Well,
I haven't missed since.
I want to get your opinion on kind of where you think the direction, as we start to wrap up over here, of where conventions are going to be going. We've just seen a virtual mentalism convention online on Facebook that was a two-day thing of 12-hour each day of back-to-back-to-back lectures. And there have been other virtual conventions like Luis de Matos had put together and some other people in the past. Yeah, and so I'm just wondering that with the downturn of attendance, I guess, if you will, at some conventions, do you think that there is room for another convention or types of conventions, or are we going to be going a different direction? Or what are your thoughts on conventions in general? Particularly, I'm speaking to you as a past international president and also, you know, kind of hosting the larger national international conventions with the IBM. So kind of what is your thinking?
Well, let me just start by saying it's been a while since I was on the convention committee for the IBM. So I have no inside scoop or track on that. Just as an observer, I think that the costs associated with large conventions continue to rise. The liabilities associated with large conventions, I think, are expanding in terms of what people expect and the risks that the producers take. I think
financially
are significant, and just also in terms of, you know, just liability of people. And I don't know what this most recent experience is going to, the effect that it's going to have on how people expect to be treated, protected in group environments going forward. But I would say that, you know, this is across all industries for the last 15 years or more. There's been a decline in the idea of membership as a benefit of something. People don't join organizations professionally in the way that they did 25, 30 years ago. You don't have – it's just the perceived credibility for being a member of XYZ society or association is no longer quite the same as it was for my parents' generation and those before them. So I think that the idea of conventions, not just for magic, but in general, it's going to be an adapt or die situation. I think some large conventions are doing a good job of adapting. Josh and Andy and the Magi Fest and the Session, creative but a different management and production approach compared to organizational conventions that depend on committees and different ways that things are funded and different ways that things get approved and the various decisions and layers of decisions that have to be made in those settings don't have to be made in a convention that is ultimately the production of one or two people, and they make all of the decisions. And I think that as a result, you see conventions like Magic Live and Magi Fest and the Session, things that are the buck stops with one or two people. They can be more agile in the way that they respond to changing environments and trends in society compared to other types of conventions. So I think that that's one explanation for how we see conventions changing. To your point about the virtual conventions, I think I'm too much in the forest to see right now, because, you know, as we speak, it's April of 2020 and we're in isolation mode. And so we're all very grateful and need the virtual element in order to interact with each other at all. Once that is no longer required, I think we'll have a different – we'll realize how valuable live interaction is.
Right.
And the ability to shake hands and pass the deck around the table and all of those things, as we said before, I think that we'll realize how valuable that is. That being said, the lessons we're learning now, I don't think will go to waste. I don't think that we'll I mean, some people will produce virtual only conventions, and I think that'll be great if they come up with a creative way to do it. I think that we should definitely take the lessons learned from this virtual time and incorporate that into the way we do conventions going forward. Maybe selling some sort of adjunct virtual attendance, limited attendance virtually to people might be something to explore.
In addition to a live convention, you're saying?
Yes, I'm saying so. You're doing a live convention, but there should, I think, there will probably be
a supplemental virtual convention.
Supplemental, or the
IBM did that for a short while. I recall many years ago, in which that we did have like a room, and David Sandy or somebody had set up, and we would go back over in there, and then the lecturer would talk with some people, and they were able to kind of interact, or that there would be a camera that was at the IBM booth or something that people would stop by.
I think that was maybe first steps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Early first steps. But the idea that there would be virtual content.
Yeah.
Some piece of the lecture would be available virtually or at least after the fact. I know other conventions in other industries, National Speakers Association, if you're a member, you can have access to certain recordings after the fact. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to learn from this that there is a market and that people are anxious and interested and willing to pay. Right now, a lot of free content as we go, but there's going to be different ways. It's another tool. It's another tool. And to say it's going to absolutely be this way, some people are going to find a way to monetize it and sell virtual content in the way that it's been. We've already seen it, and it's going to continue. I think some people will find a way to use virtual pieces of it as maybe a loss leader sort of a thing to get people in, and then they'll purchase more content from them or products from them in the future. I think it's going to have to be another consideration at a deeper level than it has been in the past, that how can we provide this virtually? How can we provide some experience of our convention to a virtual audience, and balancing the risk of people choosing that instead of the live convention is going to be the debate.
Yeah, that's true. And I would, as we close here, that I would implore people to go back and listen to a conversation I had with Stan Allen not so long ago, in which he was talking about the four C's, of a convention, of different things that have to do with, the cost and the convenience and, different things as to why people would attend a convention. And one of them is not only the camaraderie, which you could get virtually.
To a degree.
But also because of the location. If you go and have someplace that's going to be a destination city, like Las Vegas, like San Antonio, like Chicago, New York, Atlanta, different places that people want to go to take their families, to see on the vacation, so your spouse and children can either attend some of the events or at least have other things to do, because it's, again, a destination city, which you can't do in a virtual way, so there are some downsides to that and plus sides as to why you should be attending the other convention. And as you say, that as far as the camaraderie, yes, to a degree there is some virtually, but there's nothing like what we've just been spending quite a bit of time talking about, the camaraderie that we have enjoyed and the relationships that we've made over the years with actual physical interaction with people at Factors.
Well, on that topic, I will just say, as someone who's spent the last 20 years reviewing video content for Genie Magazine, I love to see magic on a screen, but magic is a live performing art in a way that is different than even music and opera and singing and even dance, but you can't record the emotion of a magical performance. I don't think you can transmit it over the internet completely. To a degree, you can, but there's no virtual convention will ever fully take the place of being able to sit in a room and have the laws of nature contradicted for your entertainment pleasure right in front of you. There's the screen will always be some kind of barrier to that experience. And we're finding ways to transcend it and overcome it and work through it and around it during this time and with varying degrees of success. And I'm grateful for it. I've enjoyed the opportunity to do it. But nobody who's watched any virtual magic over the last month or the coming month will be able to say it's the same.
Yeah, it's like attending a live concert, you know, and experiencing right. that with the rest of the crowd and jumping and dancing and everything, as opposed to doing something virtually, which there have been a lot of things done during this time in which people will be watching a live concert. Mm-hmm. It seems like Elton John had one recently that
yep.
had 100,000 people watching virtually. But you,
wonderful.
Great experience. What is wonderful? But to actually physically be there versus, you know, dancing to the music in your house, you know, by yourself.
Not a substitute for feeling the bass in your stomach.
Yeah. You know? Good point.
And it's just, it's not the same. And it's good,
sure,
but it's not the same. And I think that's the thing about virtual magic is it's wonderful. I'm grateful for it. It is filling a need for so many of us right now. But there's no reason to fear that it will replace live magic as, you know, something that people yep. value.
Going back full circle again, just like Dom Perignon is different from beluga caviar.
Right.
So there you go.
Very good. All right.
So to wrap up, the name of my podcast is The Magic Word. So what is yours? What is your philosophy of life?
What's
important to you?
What is important to me? Oh, gosh. You hit me with a deep question, and I want to sound smart, but you know, I love my family. I just pray for all of us to focus on the things that we have in common. Thank God, magic is one of them.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Joe, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it. And for those people who of us, we're not getting to attend certain conventions this year. And for those who are not attending the 4F convention or would have otherwise been listening to this podcast to hear the updates, well, this hopefully was the next best thing, sharing some of those memories. So thanks a lot for sharing yours.
Good to see you, brother. Take care.
And you too. So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Joe M. Turner. This is Scotty out. Well, thank you, Joe, very much for joining me this week and for giving me some of your thoughts on conventions as well as recollections from your experiences at the 4F convention. And thank you, listeners, also for tuning in to listen to this rather unusual podcast. Usually, again, that we like to attend conventions physically and then give you daily updates. And so this was, I guess, the next best thing since we really couldn't be at the 4F this year. But we will go back next year and we'll celebrate the 50th year in 2021, in which we'll be giving some daily updates. And same thing with future conventions. Just looking forward to when we get back out and see each other and enjoy live conventions. So again, thank you, Joe, for your time and your thoughts on that then as well. So now it's time for me to give you the names of the two winners of the 5 ebook bundles that are of books provided by Michael Breger. And I want to thank Michael very much for being a friend of the Magic Word and also for his most generous donation of these 5 books. I'll also mention that if you're interested, that you can, of course, purchase these and they are available. And if you also want them for free, that you can just be a friend of the Magic Word. This way that you can give a monthly pledge to the Magic Word. And there are several levels of giving in which that part of the perks would be to receive some of these ebooks, and ultimately that you can get all 5 yourself, again, depending upon your level of pledge. Well, let's get to it. So the two people who had won in this week's contest are Ewan Smith and Mark Ratikan. I probably butchered both those names, and I apologize. Ewan, it's E-O-I-N. Smith, I can pronounce. But Ewan, I think it's Ian, E-O-I-N. And Mark Ratikan, or Ratekin. Ratekin, I believe. So, Mr. Smith and Mark, congratulations. Thank you for entering the contest. Thank all of you very much for entering the contest. And again, there can only be a couple of winners. And so we have these contests from time to time, compliments of many of our guests that we have, as well as, in this case, one of the Friends of the Magic Word. So we thank them for their kind and generous donation. Also, you recall that we've had $100 of books that was given away just by our sponsor, The Magic Bookshop. So I want to thank themagicbookshop.com. Also for their donations in the past as well. So thank all of you guys for entering the contest, and thank those who have offered and so generously to give those gifts. In recognition of the whole thing we're going through right now, we are starting this week a new project called the Magician's Relief Project. The idea is we will be identifying a magic dealer and also some magician who is in some sort of financial need. Again, most of us all are not finding any way of making income performing for live audiences. Some are doing this, of course, through different various streaming options and things like that, and other multiple streams of revenue. But for those people who are not and might be in a more dire situation, what we're trying to do is to figure out how to help them. I know if it's going to be a choice of whether you're going to be paying the rent this month and having something to eat versus buying a magic book or something, that obviously your base needs are going to be coming first. But when everything comes back together and we're out performing then again, that you're going to be looking to try to have something new to present to your audience. And so I know that you still like to be able to buy magic, and it also helps you feel good about yourself. Well, thanks to Gene Protis and his wife Betty, who are friends of the Magic Word, they'd come to me with a suggestion, and that is for the next 10 weeks that they are going to donate $50 that will go to a magic dealer, and that way that the person whose name is drawn will then receive that $50 from the dealer. So that way that not one, but two different people are being helped out. First of all, the dealer is going to be making something on that because he's going to be selling at a retail price. And then, of course, the person who is the recipient will be able to purchase something through that magic dealer. Now, the dealers will change, and so will the names of the recipients each week. And both of those will be kept anonymous. I don't think that needs to be called out as to who it is that's being supported. But if you happen to be a magician who is in some sort of need and think that this would benefit you and you really would like to have this, or if you know someone who is, all you have to do is go to this week's podcast blog, and towards the bottom of the blog, you will see a form. All you have to do is put in your first and last name and an email address. And again, if you know somebody, just put in their name and their email address. That goes into a confidential file, and a random person's name will be selected, and you'll be contacted. The dealer will be contacted also. The money will be put into an account. The dealer will be paid, so this way that you can then purchase whatever. And most dealers will also be able to send you physical products. And, of course, a lot of times foreign shipping costs more. So if you want to use those funds for some sort of a download, I'm sure that, or a PDF file or something that is an ebook, I'm sure that there will be no shipping. And so it'll be more economical for you to get that then as well. So, again, this is called the Magician's Relief Project. And so you can help by just putting in someone's name that you know who might be in need. Also, that you could help if you would like to be an additional donor to help Gene and Betty Protis. That'd be great. All you have to do is just drop me an email. That's scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, and see if we can keep this ball rolling. Again, that this is going to be going on for about 10 weeks, and hopefully that will carry us through until we see the other side of this. And each week, that $50, as of right now, $50 a week will be going through a dealer to someone who is in need. So hopefully that we'll be able to help out a few people at least with this. So thank you, Gene and Betty, and please go ahead and go to the website and put in your name if you think that this is something that that you could use and is interesting to you. On a completely different matter, I have not been giving any updates on product reviews for quite a number of months, and the reasons are many, and I'll get into that at some future time. But one thing I do want to point out is something kind of interesting that just was released this week, and that is The Stranger, which is by Jonathan Levitt. I had spoken to him in an episode a couple of years ago when he was introducing that for the Apple iPhone, and it's now available in Android, just announced this week. So it is something that I highly recommend. I always like the idea. It's basically a Call the Wizard kind of a thing, but takes it to a completely different level. I don't know how to explain. It's just amazing, certainly, and it can be performed on stage as well as one-on-one. Many people have this as their go-to trick that they can do at any time because you always have your phone on you. Anyhow, it's just something that I want to recommend and something that I think that you should look into now that it's available not only on the iOS platform for Apple, but now on Android. So go and check out the Stranger app, and I think it's something that will work for you, absolutely. So thank you, Jonathan Levitt, for making this available finally. I know that this has been in production for a long time, and now it's come to fruition. So I am excited, and I think you will be too. So go check it out. Thanks again, Jonathan, for The Stranger. And so just a couple of last things before we sign off. And one is, of course, that we have lost someone this past week. On Tuesday, April 21st, we lost the legendary magician Norm Nielsen. Lupe Nielsen has been caring for him for quite some time in his Alzheimer's as it's gotten worse and worse, and then finally had to put him into a home. And finally, he couldn't take any longer, and so he passed. And so I thought it was important that we kind of just think about him and the contributions that he's made to magic over the years, and also our thoughts and prayers to Lupe Nielsen during this difficult time of her bereavement. I certainly know what that's like to lose a soulmate and a loved one. And the last thing is just a reminder that if you have not signed up for the pod letter, please do. This is an opportunity for you to keep up to date on what's going on from week to week on the Magic Word Podcast. And then finally, if you could also subscribe to my YouTube channel. I would like to do some additional things over on YouTube, and I can't do any live streaming or anything on there until I have 1,000 subscribers, and I need another 400 or so. So I've got a ways to go. So if you can go over and make a difference by subscribing, just look for Scott Wells in YouTube and subscribe. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to focus on the things that we have in common and to think about what you can do to help others. This is Scotty out.